24-hour emergency plumbing. Your water heater's blown? We'll have somebody out there Tuesday. Thursday at the latest.
Welcome to 200 a Day, the podcast where we talk about the 70s television detective show, The Rockford Files. I'm Nathan Paletta.
And I'm Epidiah Ravishaw. Epidiah Ravishaw. I've just recently, somebody was like, how do you pronounce your last name? I just jam it all together. That's mm-hmm. That's all I do. Ravishaw.
Ravishaw.
All right. I apologize. Go on.
Or Ravo, as we like to call you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ravo. All my friends call me Ravo.
Me and Ravo. Epi Ravo are hanging out, ready to talk about the Rockford Files. And we have a, dare I say, a good one to talk about here. With season 3, episode 8, Rattler's Class of 63.
Mm-hmm.
As all of these are, this was a predetermined choice by our traipse through our remaining episodes, which we have ordered in a way such that we are, you know, finishing out directors, writers, actors, right, kind of in roughly chronological order of the episodes that we have yet to do, you know, jumping to the 90s aside. So this particular episode is our last appearance of a David Chase script.
Mm, yeah.
Our last chase, if you will.
We're gonna miss that David Chase. I hope he goes on to do something like noteworthy.
he certainly has some chops, though. Mm-hmm. It'd be a shame if this was the last we heard of him. No, of course he's continuing on as a producer and executive producer. I'm pretty sure he didn't write any of the remaining movies, or I would not have said that this was our last David Chase. But I don't know what to say about David Chase.
That is the title for our autobiography. What to say about David Chase?
I have a book about David Chase that it's in a box. I don't remember exactly what it's called, but may I'll try and look it up and put it in the show notes.
I'm Nathan. I'm fancy. I keep my books in boxes.
It's in a box because it never got unpacked. And it's mostly about The Sopranos, right? Like, who cares about anything else? But I read the first 2/3 of it until it was all about The Sopranos. And I was like, I need to watch The Sopranos before I read the rest of this book.
Yeah.
But he also did Northern Exposure.
Right.
I remember seeing Northern Exposure just like as a show that was on TV during a block of shows on a weekend or something, like in the late 90s. And I think it ran in the early 90s. So those were probably reruns.
Probably, yeah.
I don't really have a lot of context for what the show is actually about. But from reading this book, it sounds like it kind of had that quality of like getting into the neuroses of the characters and like balancing humor and drama, like all that, you know, good stuff. So maybe in our follow-up, we'll find some key Northern Exposure episodes to to see if there's anything in there to talk about.
I remember it being a show where sort of the reason to watch it is because you got to love the characters so much.
Mm-hmm. Much like The Sopranos.
Yeah, much like The Sopranos.
I'm told. But yeah, I mean, we often talk about a script being Chasean with a couple qualities to them. If I was to list them off the top of my head, the neurotic foil character, so not Rockford, but whoever, either the villain or like the person who's bringing Rockford into the story, like they have some kind of weird psychological hang-up that becomes evident through the course of the story. I feel like that's a very Chasean moment. All the mob stuff, I mean, obviously lots of Rockford Files stuff has mob stuff, but like especially as the series goes on, a lot of the real mobby mob, like, and anything that's like going back to the East Coast, New Jersey, etc., a lot of that is Chase. But also just like really good, efficient writing. Cannell scripts have more turns of phrase. Bartlett scripts have a little more pathos, a little more emotional through line. And then the Chase scripts give us memorable characters and tight stories, like really tight stories.
This one has, I would say, a Bartlettian emotional through line as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this one actually is a little less typical of Chase.
Other than it being around a certain neurotic character.
Sure, yeah.
That we've all come to know and love.
Right. But yeah, you know, there's a bit of a write-up in the Ed Robertson book about about Chase. He joins the show, you know, between season two and season three. So this is the season that he's writing and producing. Yeah, he wrote 17 episodes. Ed Robertson notes, you know, memorable characters, Megan Doherty, the, you know, the blind psychologist. That's a Chase character. Anthony Boy, you know, those were all Chase episodes.
Just a couple of guys.
Yeah.
So memorable that it's as if they appeared twice and you couldn't remember if they were connected or not.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to quote here from the book. The addition of David Chase to the production staff completely reinvigorated Rockford. Besides sharing producer responsibilities with Charles Floyd Johnson, Chase joined Stephen Cannell and Juanita Bartlett as one of the three primary writers on the show, bringing along fresh ideas and an entirely new approach to Jim Rockford that would change the course of the series. And then there's a quote from Chase from a 2004 interview. We were free to write about anything. Writing for the Rockford Files taught me the value of story.
Hmm.
You love to hear it. And, you know, he didn't really like, I mean, he has credits before the Rockford Files, and here and there in between. But like his career is really bookend. Like it goes like a couple things, Rockford Files, a couple things, Northern Exposure.
Yeah.
Almost nothing. The Sopranos. if you're just looking through credits, I'm not passing judgment on any of the quality of the product projects in between, but just by quantity. I don't know. As I said, you love to hear it.
Yeah.
If we thought ahead, it probably would have been, maybe we'll do towards the end of our series, maybe we'll do some, you know, power rankings of our main.
The big three.
The big three. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think we're prepared to do it for this episode.
No.
This one is directed by Meta Rosenberg, who you may recognize from the opening credits of every Rockford Files as executive producer of the Rockford Files. So I was like, oh, directed by Meta Rosenberg. So she directed six episodes. And I was like, what, really? Because I just, in my head, I just hadn't, I'm like, surely we would have noticed this. Almost all of the other ones she directed were from the first couple seasons. So they were early episodes that we did because we were limiting ourselves to the first couple seasons. And they were while we were doing more of the breaking down how it works.
Yeah. And less about.
And less about like production stuff and whatever.
Yeah.
Basically, before I decided I needed to pay more attention to production stuff to fill out the show in the way that I wanted.
Every one of them bangers. I'm sorry. I'm just looking through this list. Right? Yeah. Go on. Yeah.
Portrait of Elizabeth, and then in this season, this one, and then there's one in every port.
Mm-hmm.
Next season, Quickie Nirvana, which was also a David Chase script, won the show an Emmy. Queen of Peru, one of our all-time faves. And then season five, Local Man Eaten by Newspaper, which I guess if I had to rank all these would be on the bottom. It was still a good episode. We just did it so long ago, I don't really remember too much about it. Meta Rosenberg, so since we are finishing out this third creative contribution, I guess the deal is she was James Garner's agent, and she was a big time agent in the 60s.
Okay.
She ended up becoming Garner's partner in Cherokee Productions, his production company.
Okay.
So they did Nichols together. So going back to Nichols.
Yep.
That was when she was kind of transitioning into more of this role. But as an agent, she represented Robert Redford, Alan Arkin, Ben Gazzara, some heavy hitters.
Yeah.
Before becoming this partner. And this is all pulled from the Ed Robertson book. She did show packaging. So I guess that's a specific portfolio of producer where you kind of help a client put together a series and find a partner to actually air it. But you're not like working on the show necessarily. But she was the executive producer of Nichols, which meant that she did not have a good reputation going into into the Rockford Files because that show did not do well. But James Garner had promised Meta Rosenberg that she would executive produce any project he did. And so having her executive produce the Rockford Files was a condition for Garner to do the show.
Be in it. Yeah.
Yeah. This was no problem with Roy Huggins because, and I quote from the book, I told Jim that she wouldn't actually be the executive producer. I would be running the show. Jim said, that'll be all right as long as I can give Meta executive producer credit. I don't know what producers do, really, honestly.
Right, yeah.
My understanding is a lot of the time a producer or executive producer credit is you gave us money to make this, and not necessarily anything to do with creative, you know, direction or anything like that. So I'm not trying to say like she didn't deserve to produce it or anything. Like, she clearly was part of the show the entire time, and she directed these 6 episodes, and as you said, they're all bangers. So thumbs up from me.
Yeah.
I'm sure I'd read that before, you know, because I've read the book. I did not recall the path by which the credit was gained.
That's a man who rewards loyalty.
Garner, yeah.
Yeah.
We hear nothing but good things about him, and this is one of them. Do you have anything else before we get into our preview montage?
Well, we can get into the preview montage because I got things to say about that preview montage.
Uh-huh.
Very strong Chapman open on the preview montage. It's good. It's good to see if they settled into a formula for the preview montage. Just having the lieutenant of the week yelling at Rockford at the top of each one is a good. That's a good hook for me, right? Like, that's
the list of charges is a good
just
way to get into it.
This is what Rockford will be charged with in this. In fact, if I were to go back in time and be like, dear baby Nathan and baby Epi, you're about to embark on a podcast here. Just at the top of every episode, just list all the charges that, that Rockford faces. That would be a cute gimmick. And you may at some point in like within the next 8 years regret not having done that for however many hundreds of episodes you've done. Anyways. So that was great. Then we cut to You May Kiss the Bride, and that's Angel standing there at the altar.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in. Like, I can turn the TV off right there. Like, my excitement level for this episode is just over the top. And then finally, we end with, like, there's some, you know, talk about murder, you know, death threats or whatever. And then we get the slightest hint of a car chase over a landfill, I'm into it.
I'm in. Yep. Agreed on all counts. There are a lot of things about this episode that were like, felt like coming home. And one of them is that we have the full cast. We have Jim, obviously, Angel, Dennis, Rocky, and Beth.
Yeah.
All of our favorites. So I'm looking forward to seeing how they all interact in this. 200 a Day is a 100% listener-supported show. Thanks to our patrons. In addition to our gratitude and editing access to the 200 Files spreadsheet, patrons receive exclusive episode previews every month and Plus Expenses, our bonus podcast where we talk about media, work, and our lives. In addition, every episode, we say thank you to our Gumshoe patrons. Brian Burnson has a Facebook page where he drives his Rockford tribute car to shooting locations from the show. Facebook.com/BrianRockfordFiles. Chuck Soufel's one-shot comic Sherlock Holmes and the Wonderland Conundrum is available at whatyourreadingpress.com. Find Dale Norwood's book, Trading Freedom, How Trade with China Defined Early America, wherever good books are sold. It's about fast ships, cheap drugs, and American political economy, published by the University of Chicago Press. Join Mitch Hampton to examine all matters aesthetic and what it means to be human at the Journey of an Aesthete podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. Paul Townend also recommends the podcast Fruit Loops, Serial Killers of Color, at fruitloopspod.com. Shane Liebling has all of your online dice rolling needs covered at his website, rollforyour.party. And check out Jay Adon's amazing miniature painting skills over at jayadon.com. Thank you to Andre Apignani, Tom Clancy, Pumpkin Jampa Peach Pug, Dave P., Dave Otterson, Kip Hawley, Dale Church, Colleen Kelly, David Nixon, Nathan Black, Robert Lindsay, and Jay Thompson. And finally, special appreciation for our Detective Little patrons, Joe Greathead, Michael Zalisco, Eric Antenor, Brian Pereira, Jordan Bockelman, not Brockelman, Bill Anderson, and of course, Richard Haddam. If you're interested in keeping us going for as little as $1 an episode, check out patreon.com/200a day to see if becoming a patron is right for you. And we start our episode right off with Jim driving Rocky up to the chapel. All right. After I finish my notes, so I take my notes in like a Google Doc.
Mm-hmm.
I finish my notes, scroll back up to the top, and that's when I kind of see my page count. Usually most episodes, it's like 4. Maybe I get on to page 5, depending. I have like a full 6 pages of notes on this one. I was like, why did I write so much? So I'm not going to try and hit every single beat. I don't think I'm going too much out on the limb if I say this is a highly recommend.
Yeah.
You should watch this episode for sure. But that also means there's lots of little fun things. So, you know, if I skip over something, feel free to call out anything you want to make sure our listeners are aware of. But this first scene setting up all of our action is indeed Angel's wedding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they get right to it. In fact, Rocky and I are in accordance here, because Rocky's first line, and it's like a voiceover line as they're pulling in, is, I can't believe this, Sonny. It's so sudden.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, wait, it's happening. The day has come.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a sign outside that says it's the Boyajian Martin wedding.
Yes.
Jim has been called in as Angel's best man.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes in to see Angel before the ceremony. They, you know, have this whole scene here. It's 1.5 hours notice. he's lucky Jim had a clean suit. And Angel's, in typical Angel fashion, I can't believe you're late. What are you doing to me?
Right.
And Jim, well, you only gave me 1.5 hours notice. But he's like, I'm regretting making you my best man. Jim says he can't wait to meet his bride-to-be. What kind of woman is she? And Angel says, medium height.
Yeah. so good.
We then have a real sleazeball sidle his way in. We can tell because of his plaid coat and comb over. Because Angel needs a ring. And so he's gotten in touch with this guy who's clearly like a fence or someone. They haggle over rings. He's trying to sell Angel one for $80. And Angel's like, you know my budget.
Yeah.
I don't have anything for $10.
He's got, for $10, you can't buy the ring in a bathtub, which is great. That's a good line. This episode is filled with good lines, yeah. I think. But yeah.
He's holding a 20, I believe, and he's trying to haggle. And then when he hears the strains of music, here comes the bridal march, whatever, music coming from the chapel, his face, he panics, he freezes, and the guy just takes the 20 out of his hand. So this whole time, right, this is again, squarely in the category of, I remember a lot of these scenes, but I do not remember anything about the actual plot of the episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this whole time, right, it's the, all right, what scam is this?
Right. Yeah. What's Angel trying to do? But he seems terrified.
So, you know, we go into the chapel. Rocky is the only guest on the groom side of the, and this is just like a little, like, it's all like wood. It's just like a little small.
Yeah. It's a tiny,
you know, local kind of thing. This is not any kind of big grand thing. The bride's name is Regine. Regine is played by Elaine Helville, who played Angie in The Reincarnation of Angie.
That's why I recognize
her. Yeah, I was like, oh, she seems familiar. That's because she was in another good episode where she was like the main character. So we saw a lot of her. And I remember thinking during this first part, like, it's a shame that she's not in more of this episode because she's so good. And then kind of at the end, we get the
we get that
made up for. There's a wonderful detail where there's a woman who's playing the music, and at first it looks like she's playing an organ or a piano or something,
right.
And then in another shot it's slightly wider and we see that she's hitting buttons on a record, like some kind of, you know, recorded music thing, but the way she's doing it is as if she's playing an organ.
Yes, it's good.
That's a good bit. My note here is that Angel hustles Regine about the ring.
Regine, honey, I hope you like that ring. It was my mother's. And her mother's before them.
Before her. Oh.
The ceremony completes.
Jim has to nudge Angel into saying his vows. Like, that was a good moment as well. Like,
yeah. And he's very hesitatingly going in to kiss the bride when Regine's brother Bobby breaks in, you know, runs down the aisle and starts yelling, are you crazy? What are you doing marrying this creep? Why did your brothers have to hear about this from your landlord? Angel tries to save the situation. Oh, you must not have gotten my invitation. I sent them out. You're all welcome to come to the reception. It's all the wine and linguine you can put in your face. That's when Bobby punches Angel straight in his face.
Mm-hmm.
Jim intervenes.
Oh.
Pulls them apart. Bobby yells at Angel, "You're not even Armenian."
Jim handles him. Like that was the thing. The intervention there was like, we know that Jim can hold his own in a fight, especially a meaty fight. Like if it's, you know, but like he really like had control of him during this fight, which I enjoyed.
There's a little moment where, yeah, Bobby takes a like a roundhouse swing at Jim.
Yeah.
Jim just blocks it. And then with the same hand that he blocks it, slaps him in the face.
Yeah.
It's demeaning, right? It's like,
yeah.
it really establishes mastery, like right there. So he scrambles out. He says he's going to tell all his brothers about this. Says that Angel is dead meat. And then he points at Jim, and you're next in the meat grinder, mister. After this is when Regine, clearly shaken, rallies, apologizes to the guests. There's a bunch of guests on her side, mm-hmm. which presumably are her family, her other family.
Although one of them looks like he could be Rocky's brother.
Yes. Just want to point that out. Maybe it's her landlord's family.
Oh, could be.
Everyone is welcome to the reception where there's, and she echoes Angel, all the wine and linguine you can put in your face.
Yes. She calls Angel Ev, which is great.
Yeah, it's great because Jim always calls him Angel, and then she mm-hmm. calls him Ev, and it's good when they're talking about him. I think it is probably appropriate to mention at this point, just because we have been on this, you know, this particular thing lately. I'm pretty sure none of the Armenian characters are played by Armenian actors.
Oh, yeah, probably.
Just going off of names, so I apologize if those are leading me astray, but yeah. In the name of consistency.
Yeah.
Though they are not, though in this case, as with a lot of the kind of ethnic hood kind of typologies of this era, they're not really presented as like other, like they're not like from Armenia.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not of foreign extraction, but they are ethnically homogenous, and they mm-hmm. are literally a family. Oh, so Angel got married?
Yeah.
End of episode. He must be happy. Of course not. We go to, it is night. It is Jim's trailer, and he is woken up by Angel hammering on the door, saying that Regine left him. It's clearly the same night. He's wearing his, you know, the same coat and everything. They had shrimp cocktail. It was great. He keeps referring to her in the past tense. She loved shrimp cocktail. One thing led to another. She started crying, and then she was gone. Jim does his best to comfort him, offers him a beer. In response, you don't put a Band-Aid on a situation like this. I want my wife back. And he wants Jim to talk to her. There's a good joke in the cut where he, of course, does not handle domestic disputes. That's mm-hmm. just asking for trouble.
And then
we cut to Jim talking to Regine and her maid of honor, I suppose, who's saying, tell him about the shrimp cocktail.
Yes.
So this, you know, slightly complicates matters. Angel appears to not, whatever grift Angel is on, it apparently is not leave a woman at the altar.
Yeah, yeah.
He is genuinely upset.
So we get it later on, but like, I'm trying to remember exactly how they play it out in this scene. But I think they're trying to tell Jim. No, I think they say it out. They say it out loud. The Angel wouldn't sleep with her.
Yes. Yeah.
On the wedding night. He keeps ordering shrimp cocktail and it feels like a stalling mechanism.
Yeah. She says like, I like shrimp cocktail fine, but six.
Yeah.
He just kept squirting lemon juice into tiny ketchups. He wanted to watch TV and he had to soak his back in the bathtub. Mm-hmm. And I think her maid of honor says, let's face it. He wasn't interested in making love to her.
Yes. Yeah.
Jim has a string of saying, well, Angel is unique, but he has a lot of good qualities. One note I had here was that this is the woman's apartment set that we often see for Beth at this, in this season, with all the green and yellow implants, which I always appreciate seeing.
The pillow that she's holding on to during this whole scene steals the scene a little bit, but that's yeah.
But yeah, Jim is, you know, doing his best. I think he's in that awkward place where he's like, I know how he is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, I don't even really blame you, but I am trying to stick up for him. So he says, it was just the first night. Will you talk to him? And Regine says, well, my brother set me straight.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not even who he says he is. And there's a great series of Jim facials as he processes like, okay, this was a con. What did you, Angel, what did you do?
Yes.
So I think there's a commercial break on that. And we come back to seeing her brothers. So it's a set of three. Bobby, who we already met. Ozzy, who is big, curly haired and mustachioed.
It's a very Captain Lou Albano's.
He does
vibe.
Have. Okay. So I think he's a vaudeville guy. So he's played by Avery Schreiber, who was a comedy partner with Jack Burns, if that means anything to anyone. This mustache, I guess, is a trademark look for him. He was a TV variety show guy. I shouldn't say vaudeville. He was a variety show guy.
Yeah.
And a comedian.
He's a good heavy in this.
He is a good heavy in this.
He was the tax assessor in Robin Hood Men in Tights.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm just looking through. This is the only Rockford Files.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, I remember either him or someone meant to be him. He does a voice in Thundar the Barbarian.
Yeah, he ended up doing a bunch of voice work later in his career.
You got a few Love Boat credits.
Mm. Oh, he was in Dracula Dead and Loving It. Anyway, he's great. And then they have another brother, I guess is Ed, who has almost no line, who's just the third brother.
Yeah, a warm body.
Anyway, so we cut to the parking lot. Her three brothers are emerging from a car. We see the Firebird. We see Angel peek up, see them, yes. And duck back down. And I was like, the car's going to be gone.
Yeah.
We back in their apartment. She explains to Jim that last year she was dating a guy who was sweet and she really liked him, but he wasn't rich or smart enough for her brothers or Armenian enough, which is the real flaw. And they chased him out of town.
This is Donnie Angles.
Yes, now, Donnie Angles.
We never meet Donnie Angles, but given his name,
mm-hmm.
I can only assume she has a type.
Yeah. Like, But now she married Ev and see what happened. Maybe her brothers are right. She can't manage her own life. Mm-hmm. And Jim is a little nonplussed, but wants to get back to what she said. What do you mean by Angel not being who he said he is? And that's when the brothers come in. Bobby recognizes Jim. Hey, this is the guy who pounded me at the church. It's kind of funny. It's a nice move. They come in and he immediately, like, it's really casual. Like, he leans back and, like, lights a cigarette. He smokes a lot of cigarettes in this episode.
Early days.
But they ask who he is. He's like, my name's Jim Rockford. Rockford? That's the man Martin said was a supervisor at his home office. They checked up on Angel. Turns out that the Maple Leaf Brewery in Quebec never heard of a Dr. Evelyn Martin and never planned on buying land out here. Jim's like, doctor? Wait a minute. I should have seen this thing coming. Ozzy punches him in the stomach.
Oh, good.
Doubles
punch.
Over. The other brothers grab his arms. $5,000 down the toilet for a cheap con game. Another commercial. This has a lot of like commercial break
feel.
Cuts.
Yeah, yeah.
So like the scene, you know, this is still kind of the same scene where they march Jim outside. He's like, Angel's in the car. You can talk to him. But of course, the car is gone. Right. And then it's a commercial break. We come back from commercial. You're in deep trouble, Mr. Brewmeister. Ozzy winds up a punch and Jim takes the opportunity to shift his weight, throwing one of the other brothers into him, throwing him off balance. And Jim gets a gut punch in on the other one and starts running. This is a good little chase. A lot of it, I'm going, oh, Jim's knees.
Yeah. You can see it. You can see him limping through the through part of the chase. And I remember thinking, what season is this?
Yeah.
Like, this is...
There's one shot where I'm like, oh, that must be his stunt double. Because it's like we see him running down a straightaway and then it cuts before we see his face.
Yeah. But it's fun. It's got a lot of like opening and closing things into people. But the capper,
it's a strong moment. To finish off this chase where Jim's gotten a little distance. Ozzy's following him. He starts creeping slowly to, you know, try and suss out where Jim is. They're next to an outdoor pool. This is in like the back of like an apartment complex. So
yeah, they've
like
been going through backyards for a little ways. Yeah.
So there's a pool. So Jim jumps out from around a corner and punches Ozzy right into the pool.
Yeah.
End of chase.
It's great.
We love a good punch into a pool.
It's just fun because you can watch him duck around the corner and then you're like, oh, it's going to, it's got that feel of like, you think, oh, it's going to happen. And then it happens, right? Like it's just right when you're like, yes, I want to see this happen. And then it did. Yeah.
You anticipate it and then you get exactly what you wanted.
Speaking of exactly what you want, we're going to go to Angel's apartment.
I have a lot of screenshots from this episode. We cut to Angel's apartment where he's stuffing a bag, clearly in a panic. The signature for Angel's apartment is the big fringed Texas flag.
Yes.
Always love to see that. So I do have a screenshot here just because it's so good. There's a couple things that are particularly great. One is the stack of television boxes in the corner where it's like, huh, I wonder where those are from. And he has underwear hanging off of a chandelier.
My favorite bit in this is as he's stuffing things into the bag, he tears what is probably like a picture of a woman cut out from a magazine off the wall and shoves it into his bag.
He has some pinups on the wall, and that's one of the last thing he grabs after Jim starts knocking on his door.
Right, like it's not that he's doing it while he's stuffing the bag. It's Jim starts knocking on the door, and he's like, "I got to finish stuffing
things
in this
bag. It's the panic rush.
I have to grab this pinup,
this particular one." Yeah.
Oh, it's exquisite.
He goes for the window. We know it's Jim because Jim is saying, "It's Jim. I know you're in there."
Yeah.
And Jim manages to bust the door open before Angel can go out the window. He found his car downstairs. He wants his keys.
Boy, of all the names to toss out in your little scam, you gotta go and pick mine.
But Jimmy, you got an important name, Solid Rockford. Don't that sound good?
They
Rockford?
Think I'm part of the action. Now, what was it this time, Angel? The Red Barn Con or what, huh?
Yeah, Jimmy, it's a good guess. It's a variation of the Red Barn.
Pursuant to our plus expenses, this episode is not about this con. But we do get a lot of details about how this con works, which is really kind of fun.
Yeah, that's fun.
But yeah, so Jim says that he's in it all the way now, so he wants to know every detail. Like, you brought me into this, I need to know what you were running. The deal is the Boyajians, these brothers, they own a dump that they filled and are trying to sell, and they've been trying to sell it for years. It's called a sanitary landfill. They dump topsoil over it, and then someone can potentially develop it. Oh, yeah. And then Jim's like, oh, and here comes the Canadian beer mogul. And he asks, who set the hook?
Yeah.
Like, oh, well, that was Eddie Groger. He was the VP in charge of development. So he comes in, offers the Boyajians $150,000 and to hire their crew to get everything up to code. And then Jim says, all right. And so you were the stall? Of course, Angel was. He was the VP of human factor development. So he comes in. He says, oh, we found a better piece of land up the coast. I'm overruling this guy. We're going to do a deal on this other piece of land. You jerk them around until they start offering bribes. And it sounds like, you know, they split the, you know, they got $5,000 out of them. As, you know, as the payoff. So Jim's like, okay, I know the con, but what did you do ending up married to the Mark sister?
Yeah, that's a great
the question we all want to know.
Yeah.
It was his only hope. They tumbled to the game. They sent some goons. And he says, sent some goons. And I'm like, yes, the goons. I don't recall if there was a particular time that anyone said goons and that's why we started, or if we just,
right.
That's just how we referred to them. And now it's just you know, our thing, but Angel calls them goons.
He's hip to the lingo.
Well, not heavies or gorillas or, you know,
yeah.
Couple of elephants or like whatever goons. They sent some goons, who found Eddie, and Eddie is dead. Angel found Eddie before he died. And Eddie said that they were also looking for Angel. But he didn't give him up. And then he's like, and I would have done the same for him. It's like, He's like, well, what else do you want me to do? They're going to kill me. I did make an anonymous phone call to the police. So that's his good deed for the day.
This is the best deed that an angel can do.
Mm-hmm. Jim's like, why don't you get out of town? And this, I just like this little detail where he's like, I couldn't do that. I mean, you know what happens if I break my parole?
Yeah.
But he said the Armenians are close-knit. Once he's in the family, he's gold.
Once we'd have been on our honeymoon, well, then I would have fessed up to Rashid about the swindle when we got back. She'd have taken my sides against her brother. Crazy about me.
Yeah, and once the flap with her brothers died down, you'd have been gone like a cool breeze.
Well, maybe, but in the meantime, I'd have been bringing the girl true joy.
So Jim breaks the news. The Boyajians didn't kill Eddie. They only found out about the con a few hours ago. You got married for nothing. But someone's still looking for Angel. Someone killed Eddie, is looking for Angel, and he doesn't know who to run from, which is a core Angel.
That's Angelism. So good.
Jim, call the police. I'm out of it for keeps. And drives away. Cut to cops, including Becker and Billings, pulling a body out of a ditch. Billings gets to read the ID from the wallet. Name's Robert Boyajian, Sarge. Bobby has a roll of hundreds in his sock in addition to everything else. So things escalate quickly. Time to go to Chapman's office, where we get our exciting moment from the preview montage.
Oh, yeah.
Beth is there with Jim and Angel. Bobby's brothers told Chapman what happened in the chapel. So you two are looking good for this. Jim explains that Bobby started it. There were a bunch of witnesses. Regine told Chapman that Angel called her and tried to arrange a meeting with her brothers to sort something out. And Angel's like, she's my wife. She can't testify against me. And Chapman says, she hung up on you. Becker is there as well. Bobby was shot point blank in the face. Someone who could walk right up to him, someone he wouldn't suspect. And yeah, so there's some details here that are important. Where Chapman's like, you know, you walked right up to him and gave him a face full of buckshot. Becker corrects him. It was birdshot, not buckshot.
Yeah.
Beth jumps up. This is all speculation. You have possible motive, maybe opportunity. But do you have anything at all solid to charge my client with? There's some silence. Jim says that he doesn't think the DA will file on these loose charges. And he goes to get up.
Sit down, Rockford.
What for? You can't file a charge.
Not on the homicide, not yet. But I've got you on fraud, grand theft. Complaint signed by the Boyajian brothers. Sergeant, get somebody from the Bunko squad up here. Book these guys on the Red Barn con.
Love it.
And then he reaches out and he takes their badges, like, because they're wearing visitor badges, and he takes their visitor badges. It's
so good.
It's a good move. We cut from there to outside the precinct, where clearly they've been bailed out. We start our shot with focus on Angel and someone in a suit who's his lawyer, or maybe the bail bondsman. They're in front of a sign that says like 24-hour bail bond service.
Yeah.
But Angel is demonstrably flailing, is how I put it. I guess he's like reenacting like a fight or something. It does not matter, but it is very funny. Jim and Beth come up to him. Angel greets Jim and gets a death glare.
Mm-hmm.
What are you cheesing me about? I got you off the Bunko rap. Angel, you get too close to me and I'll pull your beard out hair by hair.
Angel's beard is magnificent throughout this episode, by the way. I mean, he's always on point with his facial hair game.
It's very full.
Yeah, and when we first see him, he's kind of grooming it for the wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get this comment about it. And then a little bit later on, there's a whole like tender moment between him and Regine about like where she reaches up and kind of strokes his beard or something. Mm-hmm. It's just something that draws attention to Angel's beard throughout this episode. So, I mean, like, it should have an IMDb credit for this episode.
What does Jim have to worry about? Angel's the one someone's coming after with a lead pipe. This is when Ozzy and his other brother appear. What are you doing on the street? Beth tells Jim to just keep walking, but they do face off. Jim does a good job not responding as Ozzy tries to provoke
him.
They're getting Bobby's belongings. Guess we'll have to give him to Goodwill because he doesn't need them. He doesn't have a face anymore. He's clearly upset. So, mm-hmm. I think that's something, we're kind of filing away details of like, okay, what's actually going on?
Right.
Who knows what? What are the motivations here? At this point, clearly there's a third party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We know that Angel and Jim didn't kill this guy.
And we're reasonably sure that these guys didn't kill the other con. So, something is going on. they know where to find Jim and Angel. Like his brother keeps saying, like, not here, not now, come on, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, we know where to find you. Beth doesn't have all, she just has these two scenes, but she gets to go full lawyer mode in both of them, which is nice.
We know where to find both of you.
I'm Mr. Rockford's attorney. Should I interpret that as a threat?
Yes.
The other brother pulls Ozzy away. Beth tells them to lay low until the cops find whoever killed Bobby. And Angel says that's not going to happen while they're trying to pin it on the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
And he turns to Jim and says, you're going to have to find the real killer. Beth says, no way. But Jim, with a great facial expression of regret, unfortunately, agrees with Angel. We need to find whoever killed Bobby, or else we join the Melon Rinds in the back of a garbage truck. Cut to the back of a garbage truck.
Yes. Good joke in the cut. Same joke in the cut that they used in the preview montage, if I remember correctly.
It seems about right. Just a different shot of the... It's a different garbage truck moment, but mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So Jim is... He's doing some investigating.
He's coming in with a con.
Yeah.
Like, or grift or whatever, mm-hmm. which I was like, okay, but these people have just been conned.
Mm-hmm.
That plays out how you would expect it to play out, which I like.
Well, he's also not coming to talk to the brothers. He's coming to talk to, like, the workers who, I guess it's still an active dump, right?
Yeah.
Like, in the meantime, until someone buys it. So there's, like, earth movers and garbage trucks and whatnot. Well, because they're taking a break. So Jim comes up to these guys who are taking a break, goes to talk to one of them. He introduces himself as Leo Kale. Jim's line here is that he's from the County Health Board, and he has some questions. He's trying to talk to people who knew Robert, and he keeps demonstrably mispronouncing the name.
Yeah.
So it's like Robert Boyajin? Boyajin. Yeah, him. But he wants to talk to people who knew him on the job. He's trying to get a full picture of his movements recently because his autopsy showed signs of incipient encephalitis, which can become an outbreak. So he's trying to figure out where he might have contracted it. You know, has he been to work? Like, how has he been the last few weeks? And Leo Kale, last few weeks, I have trouble remembering what I did this morning. Says he showed up work most days. We had some yucks. He didn't deserve a snoot full of birdshot.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to know more about him, you should talk to his family. Jim has a line about not wanting to interrupt their grief. And Leo gets kind of, like, weirdly intense.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, grief? Bobby had no use for that family, and they had no use for him. The kid was a free spirit. That's when we see that the brothers are in their blue sedan rolling across the dump, mm-hmm. and they cite Jim as Jim is trying to get out of there. Ozzy has jumped out of the car. Stop that creep. He's one of the guys who killed Bobby. So there is a brief but frenetic chase here. My main note is that there's a lot of tire screeching fully for two cars that are on soft ground.
Yes.
Like, I usually don't really care, but for this particular moment, it was very egregious just because there's no asphalt to be seen.
Yeah, there's nothing to screech on.
But, yeah. How do we know it's a chase if there's not tires screeching?
Exactly. It's not a terribly long chase. Like, I got excited. It's probably been a while since we've seen a Rockford chase.
Mm-hmm.
Just by random chance, we get a lot of, like, small ones like this,
mm-hmm.
or things that just, like, somebody gets in a car and immediately has to get out or something like that. I think the last one I remember is when Dennis is told to tail Jim, and he loses him by taking a turn that forces Dennis to go over some tire spikes or something like that. But I don't even remember the episode. Anyways, and this one I was anticipating. I was like, it's early. It's written by Chase. I mean, I don't remember if Chase actually puts a lot of car chases in his, but, like, that'd be nice if he did. But it does have a nice ending to it, which is the Jim kind of plays chicken with a bulldozer and swerves just in time to send the other car straight into it.
Right. Yeah. The bulldozer has a big pile of dirt in the dozing dozing chamber. And so, yeah, Jim swerves.
The technical term for it, the dozing chamber.
Right before hitting it. And so, yeah, the following car just plows directly into the big pile of dirt being pushed by the bulldozer.
Yeah.
Which is very satisfying. Jim takes off, and we end our scene with Leo asking Ozzy who that was. And Ozzy very specifically gives him Jim and Angel's full names. It's like, oh, that's Jim Rockford. Him and Angel Martin are the, you know, the creeps that the cops arrested. But then they sprung him loose. He has a couple other choice things to say about them. And then the camera lingers on Leo nodding thoughtfully.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, so this guy, what's up with this guy? That's when I went back and made sure I noted his name, because earlier I'd said, Jim talks to a guy.
Yes.
Then I went back, oh, this is a character. His name is Leo Kale.
I also had a moment, and this, it doesn't happen to me often, but I caught the clue when the clue flew.
Which we get in the next scene, but yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's just like when he mentions Birdshot, I was like, huh. Is that common knowledge?
Right, yeah. I didn't really notice it in that moment, but it, again, it's explained in this next,
yeah,
this next scene, which features a lot of great things.
Mm-hmm.
It's time for us to take our traditional intermission, as we all need a little break to head out to the lobby, take a little stretch, get a snack, a drink, reflect on what's come before, and anticipate what's to come in this episode of The Rockford Files. We also like to take this time to remind you of where else you can find us on the internet. Epi, where can our listeners find you?
Well, you can find me at my website, dig1000holes.com. That's 1000 the number. Or you can find me as Epidaya on the Mastodon instance dice.camp or on co-host. Where can our listeners find you, Nathan?
All of my games, zines, podcast projects, and other work are at ndpdesign.com. You can also find me at NDP on co-host and over on Instagram at ndpdesign.games. And of course, you can always find this show, 200 a day, at 200aday.fireside.fm.
And now we return to the continuing adventures of Jimmy Rocco.
Jim is at Rocky's. Rocky is serving milk and sandwiches.
Ah, yes.
And this the whole conversation is held while Rocky holds a half a sandwich. Per the screenshot I just sent you.
Yes. That's so good. Noah Berry Jr.
No,
an exquisite best. Physical actor.
Rocky's saying this is a, you have a thin lead. Like, this is not mm-hmm. much. But Jim explains, look, you would assume that you'd use buckshot to kill someone with a shotgun. Mm-hmm. Even Chapman assumed that. Dennis had to correct him. How did Leo Kale know that it was birdshot?
Yeah.
This is just to tell Rocky this so that we hear that. So we get that clue as well. This next scene starts with Jim pulling up to a car dealership. And the camera stays on the dealer, whose name is Gene. Mostly he is referred to by his last name, which is Chechik. So Gene Chechik. Remember, folks, Gene's Universal Motors in the friendly city of Artesia.
I don't know for certain, but this feels like this comes straight off of a commercial break.
I think it does.
I quite like that they're filming a commercial immediately following the commercial break. Like, yeah.
It's a fun little bit.
It's a nice touch.
I also like that he's co-promoting with a big barrel of Smith's Butter Crunch candies.
I really would love to have some Smith's Butter Crunch candies right about now.
Good. This is when we see Leo Kale come mm-hmm. up to Gene while he's mid-commercial, and then he cuts the commercial. He's like, we'll pick this up later, and they walk away.
Yeah.
Jim has been tailing. So this is kind of, again, an example of that, like,
yeah,
tight storytelling that uses both the script and the screen, right? Like, at no point is Jim like, I'm going to go follow him, or we see him following right. or whatever. We get to pick up from the context that that's, you know, that's our connective tissue. That's why Jim is here. We cut to Jim literally kicking some tires outside the dealership, waiting for Chechik to come out. Talks up how he looks taller on TV, but he's come down here to get another car. He wants something that looks conservative, but has some zots under the hood. But the point here is that Leo Kale's a drinking buddy of his and told him to talk to Gene personally. And that's when we see Gene clam up. I don't know anyone named Leo Kale. I have to go talk to my mechanic. If you're interested in the car, you know, talk to my salesman who was already talking to you. I don't want to cut into his commission, and like walks away. Yeah. Jim knows that something is going on.
Yeah. This is one of those, good examples of like, when Jim runs one of his little cons, I don't even grifts. What are we going to call these?
When he does his fast talk.
his fast talk. Yeah, we're 8 years into this. Mm-hmm. We should have a word for it. Mm-hmm. When Jim does his fast talk, he's got a whole thing, right? Like, he's got a character that he's playing, and he's got an angle that he's taking. But he learns something no matter how that plays out, right? Yeah. Like, if somebody's onto him right away, that doesn't matter. That just tells him that they're waiting for someone to come mm-hmm. looking. That's the beauty of these things, is that he can do them, and then it doesn't matter how they react. He learns something from how they react.
Right.
And this one in particular, like, he goes so cold that Jim's like, oh, okay, so there is a connection. Mm-hmm. There's no way he's rebuffing me like that. Well, there's obviously a connection. He saw them talking to him, but now he wants him to, and now he knows that this guy doesn't want anyone to know there's a connection. And yeah.
I mean, that even extends to sometimes he runs a line and there's no reaction, right? Like, there's like, they just take it at face value. And then sometimes that tells them, okay, maybe this person is not involved, or mm-hmm. this isn't what I thought it was. Like, yeah, there is this aspect of no matter what, he does learn something.
Yeah.
We cut to see a shotgun being wrapped in plastic and hidden in the tank of a toilet. And then we pan up to see the suspicious face of Leo Kale.
What I have put in my notes as ominous toilet scene.
Yes, we have our ominous toilet scene, and then we go to Jim talking to Regine. He needs mm-hmm. to get some more info. She says that she knows that Jim didn't have anything to do with Bobby's death, but what about your friend? What's his rock bottom?
Yes. It's like a good line and good point.
I think by the end of this episode, we see that obviously there was a bit of a learning curve, but Regine has perfectly clocked Angel.
Yeah.
After like a couple days.
You mentioned this at the top of the episode when we talked about her playing
Angie.
Yeah, Angie. But she's great. And this is the moment in this scene is the moment when I noticed that in my notes, where mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm just really digging how she's delivering all this. Like, she's really handling this character that could have just been a joke, right? Mm-hmm. Like, she's a mark. Like, who falls for Angel?
Right.
Right? And we get a character where that's plausible. Like, it's very plausible, and it's I think it's handled quite well.
For the record, the reincarnation of Angie was our episode 53 back in July of 2019, so.
Well, there was a 2019.
It's notable that she stuck with both of us from one that we did that long ago.
Yeah.
Jim asks her about Leo Kale. Isn't he a trip to the zoo? They basically, you know, they talk about Bobby. Jim wants mm-hmm. to know a little bit more. She shares some things. Ozzy thought that Bobby was a cross to bear for the family, but now that he's gone, he feels guilty. And so that's why, you know, one reason he's acting out so broadly. Bobby was always the fun one growing up.
And then Ozzy threw him out of the house. Cut off his money, claimed it would make him a man. Just drove him closer to people like Leo. And gradually, Bobby wasn't fun anymore. He was just mean. And drunk and perpetually broke. Wedding and a funeral in 3 days. Limousine people must really love us.
Well, he wasn't broke when he died. Any idea where he got $1,000? I guess that is how much was in his sock when they pulled him out of the water.
Yeah.
She does not. He's like, do you think Leo Kale might... I forget exactly what the phrase is, but he's like, could Leo Kale have been involved? He doesn't know what it means, but he's just... Basically, he's getting bad vibes. Mm-hmm. And he thinks that Leo might have murdered Bobby. And she reacts and then goes, I don't know why I should be surprised. Leo was a Long Beach rattler.
Ah, here we go.
And I go, oh, right, the title of the episode.
Yeah. Same here. I up to this point, the title of the episode is Rattlers Class of 63. So I still was thinking there's some sort of high school connection. Mm-hmm. So I guess, well done. Well done, title of the episode.
Yeah. We cut to Becker. Yeah, I remember the Rattlers, the Sphinx, the Pyramid, King Tut. That's all ancient history. So at first I was like, oh, there was like this whole, like, are these all the gangs? And I think I'm realizing, no, he's just saying, just like the Sphinx, the Pyramid, and King Tut, the Rattlers are ancient history.
Yeah, It's
not in 63. There was a gang war between the Rattlers, the Sphinx, and the Pyramid, and then King Tut came along, which I feel like that would be a fun game to play.
Oh, that would be.
But yeah, the Rattlers were an outlaw bike gang. Jim is drawing some connections. Leo Kale went to work for the Boyajians in 63, which is when they covered their dump in topsoil and put it up for sale. Earlier, it had been mentioned that it's been on the market for 10 years. So, you know, that gets us to roughly where we're at. Jim says that Leo drove the bulldozer that did the work. And now, 13 years later, Eddie and Angel come up with their con, and Eddie and Bobby are both dead.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't know if Gene is involved, but he'll put that shotgun in Leo's hands any day of the week.
Mm-hmm.
We cut to another frantic knocking, this time at Rocky's, where Jim's snoozing on the couch, and it's Angel in a panic. If they act quick, they can get to Central Mexico. Word on the street is that the cops found a shotgun in Angel's bathroom.
Mm.
Mm. Jim calls Dennis. It's the middle of the night. This is a great, just little moment of humanity, right? Where Becker, you know, answers the phone. Yeah, he's like, I can't talk here. And then he like apologizes to Peggy. I mean, we don't see Peggy, but like one presumes as viewers of the show, he apologizes to Peggy. He's like, sorry, I have to get like, you know, in a very naturalistic way. I just
apologizes to the key grip who has to lie in bed next to him.
So he goes down to the kitchen in his nightshirt and while talking to Jim makes himself a sandwich.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Might as well.
I mean, he's like, I'm not getting back to sleep.
Right now, I'm loving this whole cast, but, you know, it's a bit of a shame that Jim doesn't already know Coop.
Yeah. Just for the biker angle.
Biker gang, yeah. Oh, my God.
Go back and see if the Rattlers are involved in the Curse of the Black Shadow or Return of the Black Shadow.
I hadn't even really taken that scene in. I'm glad you took that picture because it's a whole production. Like
he brings out the bread, the big jar of mayonnaise, the cheese and the meat.
And the table is set. Like it's set for dinner. Like it looks like in the Becker household, when they're done with a meal, they just set it up for the next one.
Just in case he has to get up overnight.
Yeah, which makes sense. I mean, like he might have to get up early in the morning or whatever. But yeah, good stuff.
So Becker turned up that in 1963, Kale, Gene and a now deceased third Rattler. So they were both Rattlers were arrested for the murder of two rival gang members. But the police at that time never found the bodies. They had corpus delicti problems, couldn't make the charges stick.
You're thinking what I'm thinking, aren't you, Dennis? That Angel and Eddie Groger were making phony offers on a secret graveyard.
You know, all you need is a good set of dental records to nail them.
I mean, Chechik and Kale couldn't know the land purchase was a phony. They got to think that the bodies were going to be exhumed.
Dennis says that's the sheriff's jurisdiction. Have you ever heard of probable cause? Bobby's murder is in Dennis's jurisdiction, and Jim and Angel are wanted in connection with that. So you should come in. Jim says that the shotgun plant is so obvious you ought to water it.
Oh, it's such a good line.
It's not just wanting to talk to you anymore. Like, the beef on you now is conspiracy to commit.
Mm-hmm.
And Becker hangs up, which I appreciate. I think it's kind of like as a friend.
This is a warning.
Yeah. I'm not on duty this particular moment as I'm making my sandwich, but I'm hanging up the phone now. We go to just a soupçon of another con that we get explained a little more in subsequent scenes. Jim's in a suit. He's talking to a real estate agent at the entrance to the landfill. He wants to buy the property. His engineers will rip the toupee off to see if it's buildable. They're going to, in addition to the motorhomes, they're going to build an Olympic-sized swimming pool and a fieldstone clubhouse. And then we'll see what the development opportunities are after that. The real estate agent is, you know, reminding him that it's a sanitary landfill. They're going to have to, you know, pack the soil, etc. And Jim says he's willing to take the risk. He'll buy the option in case, you know, it can't be built on or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
His character here is that he's sweating and he keeps dabbing his neck with his handkerchief.
It's a good, bold choice.
But yeah, the whole hustle here is that he's eager to buy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think reading between the lines, right, he's like, Yeah. Following up on my theory, everyone who wants to buy this
is dead.
Yeah. Someone else who is involved in some way, we're still not quite sure how, is also dead.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm gonna poke that bear and see what happens, right? We go to Gene and Leo. Gene's saying, I told you not to come out here like this. So why do you answer my calls? There's another buyer who wants to rip up the landfill. And we follow them to their conversation at said landfill. In the background are a bunch of kids playing like pickup football or frisbee or something.
Yeah.
You know, on the landfill while they talk. So it's a nice little dramatic contrast there with the topic of their conversation. So we learn that that is indeed what happened. They did bury those guys 13 years ago. Gene says they should just dig up the bodies. Then it won't be a problem anymore. Leo, what? I should come up with a dozer and dig through 8 feet of garbage?
Mm-hmm.
So do it at night.
I was only 25 when we had that rumble with these bums. It was an accident. I was drunk. How long am I going to have to keep paying for it?
Until you buy this property and pave it all over like I told you to.
Gene says, you know, you're always running your mouth.
Yeah.
I think you wanted Bobby to blackmail me. You've always resented me. And we'll come back to that in a second.
This is a scene that I totally thought that they were setting the audience up for when these two kill each other.
You could read it that way for sure.
They both knew that each other was like on the edge of talking or doing something that they shouldn't have done or something like that. And they have this dark secret. So one of them has to die.
So Leo wants Gene to find out about this buyer from his real estate contact. You know, there's mm-hmm. just like, you know the real estate people or something.
And you'll do the thing.
What thing? Oh, the killing. You and me are partners. And your hands are going to stay as dirty as mine. And when we snuff Wakely, you're going to buy this land, and me and you ain't never going to see each other again.
That's Leo's plan. Yeah, I think so. I didn't necessarily make that read in the moment. I think that I see it. Like,
mm-hmm.
they clearly hate each other.
Yeah, they hate each other, and there's
but they're bound together by this secret,
dark secret. Yeah.
So I guess the question, and I don't think this is really addressed later, so we might as well talk about it now. So is the implication here that Bobby, whether because Leo wanted him to or not, found out about the bodies and went to blackmail Gene because he always needed money, and then Gene killed him? Or that he went to blackmail Gene, that was too far, and Leo killed him?
That's a good question. I ended the episode thinking Leo had killed him, and now I don't know why.
Yeah, I guess there's an extra step if Leo killed him. Leo does have the shotgun, so I guess that would imply that he did kill Bobby. And the reason he has the money is because he got it, right? That $1,000 was a payoff
yeah.
from Gene, is the other connection we're supposed to draw here.
There's a thing in this scene where it sounds like Leo has been doing the dirty work.
Yes, yeah.
And it's time for Gene to step up. But
right.
Yeah, it's a little muddled in my head. Mm-hmm. But
yeah.
It doesn't matter. The action keeps going.
That's true.
It's pushing us forward.
Yeah, it doesn't particularly matter in any functional way, other than it's a little like there's clarity of like someone wants to buy the dump and then they get killed, but mm-hmm. then Bobby gets killed and it's like, well, it's not that he wanted to buy the dump, but
right.
I guess he found out about the secret, right? And I guess there's just that extra step of he revealed that he knew the secret and thus he had to die.
Yeah.
We cut to Jim, Rocky, and Angel playing cards. There's a good visual bit where Jim pulls Angel's hand down to see the cards he actually has.
That's good.
Rocky answers the phone, and he clearly has been coached for this moment as he says, so there's whatever the false name that Jim gave for this, his real estate developer. Yes, it's his residence. No, he's not here. No, he went fishing for the weekend. Nope, the whole weekend. Yep, he went all alone up to Flinthead Lake. He's all alone up there with no phone. No, he won't be hard to find. He's in a white camper with green trim. giving our marks exactly the information we want them to have to execute on this con.
I just want to point out that during this phone call, it does the physical interaction between Jim and Angel is Jim trying to keep Angel from running away.
Yeah.
It's just what it feels like. It's good. It's good stuff.
All right. So Jim and Angel are in a camper. Jim's kind of up in like the over cab
part. Yeah.
The mother's attic of a U-Haul, if you are familiar with that branding. He's forcing Angel to lie in the bunk like one would if one was asleep and pretend to be asleep. Jim's saying there's going to be no problem. As soon as they come through the door, I'm going to come down on them. You're not even going to have to use that Georgia toothpick, which is the baseball bat that he gives to Angel. I love this little detail. Angel's saying, why don't we just make up the bed like there's someone in it? And he starts explaining how he's like, back in the Navy. And Jim cuts him off. Oh, yeah, there is like a couple things here and there of like, you know, Angel serving, you know, having some service time. Would Jim have risked borrowing this camper from Rocky's neighbor and damaging it if he thought something nasty was going to go down? That is a great look from Angel, like, uh-huh. We cut back and forth from the rest of this conversation to the approaching car with our former Rattlers getting some, you know, some building tension. Angel's supposed to be on his honeymoon right now.
Such a great line.
I had a good woman and look what I did. There's a moment in here. I didn't take the screenshot because I take enough screenshots, but there's a moment in here where I paused it to make notes. I looked up and the staging is Jim is draped over like there's kind of like a box thing that he's kind of hiding behind. His arm is over it as he talks to Angel and he's holding his gun. Jim is expecting trouble.
He does say that he's going to make him freeze or something like that. So he is clearly indicating that he's going to pull a gun on someone.
I could have been with her tonight, holding that warm, sweet body instead of this fungo bat.
Save the Hank Williams when you left my fiddle at home.
What, I ain't entitled to have regrets?
The only thing you're upset about is the spot you're in. What about the spot you handed Regine, huh?
I had to stay alive. You are alive. Be happy.
It's good stuff.
We go outside and we see that there's stick-on letters of the like alias that Jim has been using to make it very clear which camper it is. They hear noises. Jim whispers to Angel, be easy. We want them to come inside. The whole idea here is we're going to give the cops probable cause because they're going to come in and it's attempted murder. Outside, we see Leo messing with the gas cap of the camper. We go inside. Did you lock the cap to the tank like I told you to? Angel, I forgot. And they run out of the camper.
My notes are, we're getting an explosion.
Yep. And you are correct. As they dive out, we cut to a wide shot and we see the camper explode. Gene's in the car, sees them run out. It's that guy Rockford. Leo has a gun. He jumps in the passenger seat. Exchange shots with Jim. They try to drive away, and we have a good Jim taking a very steady aim.
Yeah.
He takes a shot. It's a little unclear if it like hits their tire or just makes them swerve, but either way, they swerve into a rock, stopping them in their tracks. The horn is blaring. Another camper comes over to see what's happening.
Guy comes running out. Yeah.
Jim's like, call the police. And then he keeps his gun on our two
would-be assassins, former Rattlers.
And he tells Gene, hope you're as good at selling stories as you are at used cars. Justice is presumably served.
Mm-hmm.
And we go to our final scene with Angel in Jim's trailer. Jim is in a foul mood, and the last thing he wants to see is Angel. All right, so Angel has like a liquor box with records in it.
Yeah.
He wants to hide them at Jim's because the divorce has been finalized. Regine is going to get them in the settlement if he doesn't hide them.
This is, it's good business. It's fun. It's also a lovely detail. I mean, we'll get a little bit more of it in a moment, but what I guess the thing I just really love about it is that it starts off as a, like, I don't know, like a divorce joke. I don't know if that makes sense, but like, oh no, she's going to take me for everything. But it actually, like, we get this filtered view of the romance between Angel and Regine. She clearly has sentimental attachment to these records. Like, that's going to be a thing. And that's a nice humanizing thing, right? Like, and Angel is also attached to it. So, like, there's common ground there somewhere, right? Like, that exists.
Of all the things that Angel is worried about, it's the records.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, yeah, gives us a little, like, you know, he does care about something.
Right, yeah, yeah.
It's not that they're particularly valuable. I mean, he runs through a couple titles.
Yeah.
It's not like they're ill-gotten gains and he needs them to, right. Like, flip.
They're not TVs in boxes stacked in his apartment.
Well, Jim is in no mood. So now we get the outline of everything that Jim has done off screen.
Yes.
Jim was just talking to someone at the bank. He had to refinance his trailer to get the $2,000 that he had to use for his deposit when he was posing as a real estate guy to get the option on the property to convince everyone that someone was going to buy it. Plus, he's on the hook for renting a bulldozer, which I feel like there's something earlier where I was like, oh, that was the bulldozer. But
yeah, I don't remember other than to make it look like he was legit about digging through it.
And Rocky won't even talk to me because his friend's camper did a patty melt.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah.
It wasn't just fast talk to get to that point. He did have to actually put up some money to make it look legit. Enough for everything to go down the way he wanted. So again, the goal of the con was not to make money. The goal was to get these guys for, you know, attempted murder, which was successful, but there was a cost.
Or very specifically to get Angel and Jim out of the line of fire with that. Yeah, this is, I mean, you know, we've seen Jim out of pocket in a lot of episodes, but I think this is like...
pretty out of pocket, yeah.
Yeah, this is like top five.
It's not stated or implied that he's supposed to replace the blown up trailer, just that Rocky's mad at him about it. But you wonder, that might be part of it as well.
Yeah.
This is when Regine knocks. Angel wants to know what she's doing there. Jim said that, oh, you know, she asked me to help her with something. Angel has this moment where he's like, oh, I forget the guy's name.
Donnie Angle.
Yeah. Jim implies that it's like a missing persons case. And Angel's like, oh, that guy, what was it? Jimmy Angle?
Donnie Angle.
Yeah, and he was like, oh, that guy Donnie Angle. And he's like jealous, which is very funny. So Jim lets her in. Angel's still holding the records and he's like crouching in the kitchen behind the little divider, like hoping he won't be seen, but it is clear that he's there. Jim says, like, let's talk at the restaurant. I'll go get us a table.
Extricating himself. Well done, Jim.
We have the most unexpectedly touching scene I can recall from the Rockford Files once Jim leaves the trailer.
Yes, this is so good.
I'm kind of expecting some business about like the divorce or, you know, whatever, but there's immediate tension, like neither of them knows what to say. Obviously Regine is not vindictive, right? She sees what he's holding. Those are the records, aren't they? And Angel starts off with, Jimmy was helping me create them, and then we're going to mail them to you, you know, get everything sorted. There's a moment where they're looking at each other, and then Angel just goes,
I'm lying to you. I'm lying. Boy. The shuck just comes out of my mouth like the fumes out of a city bus. I was going to hide the damn records here. I'm sorry.
I think, is this the only time we've seen Angel not performing?
Right. It's certainly the most vulnerable we've ever seen him that I can think of. And aside from, like, obviously when he makes himself look pathetic to try and get Jim to help.
Yeah, yeah, the moment where he's like, because we're friends, like that moment, yeah. Like that's nice, another one that's vulnerable, one. And pretty real. But there's something, and this is a testament to Stuart Margolin, right?
Yeah,
there's something here where he's still 100% Angel, he's still 100% this character, but this character is for once not performing for the person he's talking to in the moment.
Yes, yeah, or like distracted, because that's his other mode.
He says he doesn't know what else he could have done. He thought that they were going to kill him, right? The brothers.
I know that. But I could have helped you. You just never asked. You didn't give me a chance. You lied to me when you asked me to marry you, and you made me feel like I didn't exist at the motel. Why couldn't you talk to me?
Because I was so uptight. I mean, all night long, all I could see was this lead pipe hit me on the head. Fact is, I didn't see you at all.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. This conversation was very touching.
Yeah. You know, he has this line where he's like, I like you. There's nothing phony there. And you believe it. Like, you absolutely believe it.
Yeah, he's not like, I love you or like, yeah, whatever. It's like, it's that very real, like,
yeah,
I like you. I feel regret for how I've treated you.
Right, how I hurt you.
But at the time, I couldn't do anything else.
Yeah, he's like, I was scared. I was terrified. And then she just has this great thing where she's like,
you were just scared.
Yeah.
You're always scared, aren't you, Ev?
I mean, both of them are doing just an amazing job.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both being, like, incredibly honest, too. Like, she also has that great line about, like, I even wish that they'd hurt you, like, once or twice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's glad that he didn't get hurt, even though she wished that he would have once or twice.
Yeah.
And he goes, I dig.
Yeah, yeah.
I get it. That makes sense.
This final scene is worth the episode. Mm-hmm. And the episode itself is an absolute delight as well. But then, for my money, the final scene is like an amazing capper to the episode. And then the final frame is an amazing capper to this scene.
So we get to the end here where she's going to go talk to Jim. Angel stops her. And he kind of makes like a last, kind of a like, let's start fresh.
Yeah.
Sally, right? Like, he's like, what? But he's really hesitant and mumbly. Could we try? Let's go out to dinner.
My schedule's free. You say, yeah, yeah.
And she's like, no. He's like, well, what if we stay here? We can drink Jimmy's beer and use his record player. Which, again, great. And she says no. She offers him her hand for a handshake. He shakes it. And then there's another moment. And then I think this is where you mentioned she reaches up and kind of like touches his beard, starts closing in as if for a kiss, and then stops. And then, like, with a trembling, tear-filled voice, you take it easy now, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when she leaves. She goes outside. Jim's waiting, asks if she's okay. She says yes. And then with no music, no score.
Oh, you got it. Yeah,
oh, I got
it. Of course
it.
You got it.
I mean, and this is the freeze frame for the end of the episode.
Yeah.
And we just, in the foreground, have Jim with his arm comfortingly around Regine. She's smiling with a, I'm getting myself together, smile. And in the background, Angel has come out of the trailer and is just standing there looking at them.
Yeah.
With one hand on the open door.
It's so good. It's heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking. He's watching his best chance walk away.
Yeah, yeah.
Best chance, I don't know, at happiness, at a connection with someone that's on a more fundamental level, like, whatever. He's watching walk away. He knows there's nothing he can do.
Mm-hmm.
For the rest of the series, we're just going to get the Angel we know.
I don't know if Jim's his closest friend, right? But let's assume he is.
I think for the purposes of the show.
Yeah. And, like, this scene starts with Jim, like, just explaining to him all the money Angel has cost him. This whole episode is about Angel messing up Jim's life, but it's also all about Angel messing up Regine's life. So, it's just great. It's just this great thing where he doesn't know. He can't help himself. Mm-hmm. And then he has to, like, look upon the fruits of his labors at the very end. I loved it. Yeah. Good stuff.
It is extremely good. That is the end of the episode. In the write-up in that Robertson book, it says that this was reportedly Stuart Margolin's favorite episode. And
yeah.
I believe it.
I believe it, too. It's a good one.
It's a good one.
No music, just an angel staring out at the wreckage of his life.
There was a line in the book about, like David Chase brought a new, you know, breathed new life into the character of Rockford. I feel like there's some elements here of breathing life into some of the other characters, like including Angel.
Yeah.
This is arguably, again, the only time that we see see a human side of Angel, where he's not trying to scam and he's not trying to run.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, actually, I think that's the main thing, because, like, when we have that other moment with Jim, he's desperate for help. And in this particular case, there's nothing Angel, like, needs. maybe what I'm saying, but there's nothing he's angling for. He just knows he's hurt her and he's trying to like do the right thing to correct that in any way he possibly can. Well, right. Not any way he possibly can, but like he's trying to do the right thing and by laying himself out there, which is great. It was good stuff. Really good stuff. And she was amazing playing opposite of him in this.
Yeah, she's great.
That is a role that could have been phoned in and the episode would have been fine. But the fact that she did it, it just nailed it, just elevates the episode.
It's a scene where obviously if we know the context, it hits harder. But like, it's almost like a like an audition scene.
Yeah.
You could have just the conversation of the two of them just with the lines that they have and see how deeply an actor can inhabit that moment to get that emotional connection. I feel like would be a challenge. The fact that they both do it is really good. That scene really touched me and I'm not quite sure why. I mean, I kind of know why, but like, I'm not quite sure how to put into words, like, what about it exactly was so impactful. Part of it, I think, is that we've spent so much time with Angel.
Yeah.
So kind of like seeing the real Angel, it was just such a surprise, a delight, but a sad one.
Yeah.
We only see it because we know that it's transitory and that he's lost this chance.
There's a thing. Think about Angel, like we see Angel's apartment, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not like we talked about it. It's a mess. In fact, we probably could do a whole episode on what we see of Dennis's house, what we see of Angel's, and what we see of Beth's or that kind of thing. Yeah, but and it's obviously both like his in-universe situation is evident in it, but also like it's a reflection of him.
Mm-hmm.
He's got these bare walls. He doesn't have bare walls. He has
he has a couple of pinups. He has a Texas flag. And
Texas flag, yeah.
And underwear hanging on a chandelier.
Yes, yes. And a water heater that Jim can back him into at some point. And
yes.
That's great. That's all well and good. And it all informs us about the character. But this scene just really, really puts it out there, right? Like I don't know how to otherwise say it, but like, yeah, I think you're right when you talked about how great it is, to watch this character who is always got an act going, drop that act and still have this character there at the center.
It's great. And unexpectedly so. The plot is over. We've wrapped up, our villains. We know what was going on. We've answered all the questions. And then we get this all-time great scene from the series. Like a top 10, if not top 5 individual scene.
Yeah.
Just coming in, just hot off the, hot off the back of a good episode.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, the episode didn't need it, but it got it. And that was great.
Yeah. So I think at the beginning we said some, or at least I said, I don't remember if you agreed with me, but that this isn't necessarily the most Chasian of episodes kind of in total, but I'm glad that it's the one we ended on because as an episode, it's so memorable for us as deep divers into the show. This is kind of like an instant classic just for that last scene alone.
Yeah.
And then we get all the other stuff with the different groups with different motivations all clashing with Jim having to run some cons.
All the lovely con business.
Yeah, all the con business, which it's not a con game episode. We're not watching the cons unfold, but we get a great texture from just the explanation of the cons, which again resonates with some of the stuff I've been reading and watching recently. So that's, that was good for me.
Bonus.
It's extra bonus. A fun surprise in the sense of now that we have a specific progression, it's just going to be like, well, let's see what this one has to say. What does this episode have to offer? That was great. I don't think I have anything else to say about this episode.
I think we've done it.
Goodbye, David Chase. Goodbye, Meta Rosenberg. I mean, they're still producing. We will see the names in the credits, but we will be moving on to some of our other longtime writers mostly and some directors. as we continue chasing down the end of the Rockford Files. But we are not there yet.
Mm-hmm.
We still have many more fun surprises to discover, I think.
Yes.
So we will be back next time to talk about another episode of the Rockford Files.
Oh, wait, no, it should be. Ba 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 da 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 da